Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulippe. This week, a few pre-taped conversations, one with conductor-violinist Dawn Harms about the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, for which she was recently appointed music director. Their opening concert this Sunday features mezzo-soprano Frederica von Stade. We'll also touch on some of the other ensembles that Dawn is involved with, one of which, the San Francisco Opera, has its opening gala tomorrow evening, Vuitos Mephistopheles. I'll be talking with bass Ildar Abdrazakov, who is singing the title role. Also on the music front, it being the beginning of a new month, Joshua Cosman offers his classical picks for the month ahead. Local historian Laurie Ungaretti, talks about tours of the Sunset neighborhood as part of this month's Architecture in the City Festival. And Diane Keough will be by to share her take on some recent cultural offerings. A lot to squeeze in, so let's get right to it. I'm pleased to welcome back to KLW Dawn Harms. She was recently named music director of the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony after a year-long search, and she conducts her first concert in that capacity this Saturday, September 7th, at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, in a program of Verdi, Richard Strauss, Rachmaninoff, and Jake Heggie, with sopranos Melody Moore, Marisol de Anda, and the great mezzo-soprano Frederica von Stade as guest soloists. In addition to her work with bars, she continues her duties as violinist with the San Francisco Opera Orchestra, associate concertmaster for the New Century Chamber Orchestra, and co-concertmaster with the Oakland East Bay Symphony. And that's just some of the things on her very busy musical plate. Dawn, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So much on your plate, but let's start with congratulations. Now, the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony is a group for which you were also soloist recently, playing the Four Seasons of Buenos Aires by Astor Piazzolla.
Yes.
And you were one of the candidates this past year for the search for music director. So
yes.
You landed that pony. It's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I did. It was a wonderful experience to get there, and I was thrilled to be announced as the music director.
You self-identify with the bar's mission statement, which we'll talk about in a minute, and Bay Area Rainbow Symphony is a mixed group of musicians. Breeders are welcome. In fact, I believe about 30% of so of the membership identify as straight. But tell us how you interpret the bar's mission.
Well, the mission, it's an orchestra, I think, that's unique because it's a safe place for people to be themselves. Not that you can't be yourself in classical orchestras today. We're very lucky. We live in a bubble here in the Bay Area. However, bars gives them an opportunity to be themselves. They can be gay, lesbian, transgender, straight, anyway, and it's a safe environment for them to express themselves musically. And we try to have a gay or lesbian soloist and or composer for every concert. It gets difficult. And we research, is this composer gay sometimes? But it's more to promote a safe place, not that it has to be gay. But I want it to be all-encompassing. I actually want it to be, my goal is every concert, it's the place to be. It's where, it's like a party that people want to come and enjoy and just have fun and see people loving the music. And I think this group of people do that.
Well, you're very busy as a freelance soloist and with your work with the opera orchestra and these other groups I mentioned. But I should mention that conducting isn't just something you dabble in. You were recently chosen as a fellow at the exclusive American Academy of Conducting at the Aspen Music Festival, where you worked with some of the top conductors of the world. And some recent guest conducting engagements include the Palo Alto Chamber Orchestra, Livermore Amador Symphony, and Symphony Parnassus. So
yes.
You're no stranger to that podium.
Yes, recently. It's actually happened quite fast, and it helped to go to Aspen. That was a huge draw. It was a wonderful experience. And, you know, you're not there to be complimented. Boy, they put you through the ringer, and it was good for me. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful because I was one of the oldest ones, and I was one of the few women out of 17, 26-year-old boys. So it was it was quite challenging. But I have to say it was wonderful because I felt great with everything I do. I drew on that. My chamber music, my solo, being under conductors, many different conductors, and it teaches me actually what not to do. Because when you're in the orchestra, you know you have to listen and you have to be very flexible. But you see conductors like, and they're just being expressive, but that's a four pattern, and it's just a little bit like they're swatting flies. So I try to be one thing as clear as I can, musical but clear, and I think it's possible. So it's kind of fun for me to now try it and see what I can accomplish. And the orchestra becomes your instrument, because you don't have an instrument. They are your instrument. So you have to be team, have to actually have teamwork with them.
Well, you've had a wonderful training ground under such wonderful conductors at the San Francisco Opera.
Yes.
So that's a learning experience in itself.
Yes, it's fun.
Well, let's talk about that symphony coming up with Bars on the 7th. Quite a program.
It's huge. It's very challenging, and I've really brought the orchestra through it. They've worked very hard, and I'm very appreciative of them. I wanted to start this off. It's the gala concert, and I'm their second music director, the first woman, and I just wanted to start off with a bang. So I asked, you know, it doesn't hurt to ask, my dear friend, Federica von Stada, if she would just happen to sing. And she said, yes.
Wow.
And Jake Hagee also said, sure. You know, he had a piece already written, and Flicka had sung it before.
We're so I said, talking about Primary Colors.
Very good. Thank you. Yes. His Primary Colors from his Deepest Desire songs. And she sings that as well as the Rosenkavalier. And it's so glorious. So that started off with a bang. And then I wanted something to be cohesive, rich. What would work with that? And I thought, Rachmaninoff second. Now, it's a very long piece, but it's one of the longer symphonies. It's just under an hour, but we have a few little cuts in it that work, that Rachmaninoff approved, and so it's about 50 minutes. So, but it's wonderful. It just takes you through this whole storyline. It's almost like an opera.
Well, you're also, speaking of opera, you're bringing quite a bit of operatic repertoire to this first program as well.
Yes. I mean, I was thinking, is it too much opera? Because in June, I'm doing a concert where the movies meet the opera, and we're also doing a lot of singers coming in. But I think because of my opera background and my quartet, my chamber music background, it just seemed the thing to do. And again, I wanted to start off with a bang with Federica. And it is operatic, but again, it's Verdi's 200th birthday. So the overture of La Forza is incredible. So I thought that's a fantastic beginning.
And then this wonderful trio from Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier is a highlight of the program.
Trio and the duo, yes. And we're so lucky to have San Francisco's favorite, Melody Moore, as well.
Yeah.
And you might wonder why we're having a 17-year-old unknown singer do Sophie, the part of Sophie within the trio.
This is Marisol de Anda.
Yes. She was chosen by Federica. Federica said, you know, who's your Sophie? I said, I don't have a Sophie yet. I'm looking. She said, why don't we give some person an opportunity? She loves to cultivate young talent. And
she has such a great devotion to San Francisco, too. It's wonderful.
She does, as well as the East Bay. She really tries to help a lot of also underprivileged children. So she told me about Marisol, and I called her, and she was thrilled to learn the part. It's quite a challenging part for a 17-year-old, but she sounds glorious. She came to our rehearsal Wednesday, and she just sits very, very high, and she just sings like a bird, so it's beautiful.
Well, speaking of great singers, you're already well into rehearsals for the opening productions of the San Francisco Opera this season.
Yes.
Tobias Picker's Dolores Claiborne, some drama there already, as the mezzo-soprano lead, Dolores Zajic, who, for whom the role was created,
yes,
has had to withdraw for health reasons, being replaced by the wonderful Patricia Rosette, who is also at the heart of the season opening production of Boito's Mephistopheles,
yes,
in two roles as Marguerite and Elena. So this is quite a way to start the season for you guys.
It is. It was quite, you know, opera's dramatic, and we continue that. There's also drama in the pit as well. So the neat thing about is that Kathy Cook, I would say Patricia Rosette, obviously she's the draw, she's the name, but Catherine Cook is the understudy, and she's going to do two of the performances, and she sounds glorious. So she's actually sung it. She's been the only one that has been singing it in our rehearsal so far. So she's very prepared, and I think obviously Patricia is a quick study, so she'll learn it very quickly. But it's fun to have the two, you know, to see, compare how they do it.
So yet another world premiere here happening at the opera. How is the Tobias Picker rehearsals going compared to, say, something of a more mainstay like the Boito?
You know, it's interesting because we don't know it. We didn't know it before we went in. Obviously, that's a world premiere. It's challenging because the pitches are a little contemporary. So the singers have a different pitch than you do, and the violin part is really high. But I think the collaboration will be a great end result. However, it's a pretty depressing story. When I hear the libretto, it's pretty shocking as you're playing along, but you can't drop your fiddle. You know what? You know, you're playing along and you look at the libretto. Did he really say that? But it makes great drama.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn to your other one of your other orchestras, the New Century Chamber Orchestra, the conductorless ensemble for which you are co-concertmaster. New Century's first concert is happening later this month as well, featuring works by featured composer Michael Dougherty. Maybe we can get him on later this month prior to that concert. But tell us a little bit about his music.
Well, you know, his music, I actually know a lot of his bassoon music because I played in his Dead Elvis, a piece. It's a chamber group that's patterned after the Stravinsky L'Histoire, Sonate. And so it has the same instrumentation, and he wrote it for solo bassoon. So it's very tonal, and it always has a storyline. It tells a story within it. So to me, it's kind of, again, like an opera without the singers and the costumes. And it's very tonal. I think it's very accessible to everyone. So I think people, the audience, will really like it. Unfortunately, I'm taking that set off, so I will not be there in September. Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful beginning, and he is our composer in residence this year.
Right. So more information about those concerts, even though you're not involved, is at ncco.org. Information about the opera productions, sfopera.com. And at for the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, again, that program this Saturday at 8 o'clock at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Music of Verdi, Strauss's trio from Der Rosenkavalier with Frederica von Stade, as well as Melody Moore, Marisol de Anda, Jake Heggie's wonderful work Primary Colors featuring Flicka, singing that, and Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony. More information at bars-sf.org. Dawn, thanks for taking time out of your very, very busy, wonderfully musical life.
My privilege. I'm thrilled to be here.
Let's conclude with an excerpt from Der Rosenkavalier and the great Frederica von Stade singing. This is from Der Rosenkavalier. Frederica von Stade. I wish we had more time for that beautiful music. Just a tease for you, go to bars-sf for tickets for this Saturday's Bay Area Rainbow Symphony performance. Time presses on. Last week on Open Air, we had an overview of the month-long Architecture in the City Festival. Full information at archandcity.org. This week, to drill down on one particular event, is local historian Lori Ungaretti. It's a walking discussion of how the Inner Sunset transitioned from sand dunes to developed neighborhood called Inner Sunset, Birth of a Neighborhood, taking place on September 11th. Lori is the author of three books on the subject, Stories in the Sand, San Francisco's Sunset District, 1847 to 1964, Then and Now, San Francisco's Sunset District, and San Francisco's Sunset District from Arcadia Publishing in 2004. Lori, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you.
Now, let's talk about this area, the Sunset, originally called Outside Lands. I guess that's where the Outside Lands Festival got its name, too.
Yes, the one of the big nonprofit groups out there, the Western Neighborhoods Project, the website is outsidelands.org, and we have discovered that if we type in outsidelands.com, we get the festival. But at one time in the mid-1800s, anything outside the city limits was called outside lands. And that included some areas of the Mission District and other areas in San Francisco. But as time has gone by, it has tended to mean just the west side of the city and primarily the Richmond District, Golden Gate Park, and the Sunset.
Mm-hmm. When did this area, outside lands, become a part of San Francisco?
It actually went through the courts for about 15 years. The city petitioned, it was federal land, and the city petitioned for that, for ownership of that land in 1851, and it was settled by a U.S. Supreme Court declaration in 1866. And that's when they built the park, and they developed a lot more of the Sunset District area as homesteads for people.
What was the purpose of incorporating it into San Francisco rather than its own entity?
Well, its own entity wasn't really doing very much, and the city was growing a great deal. As many people who study the gold rush know, it went from about 15,000 residents to about 50,000 in about a year when the gold rush hit. The city was growing, and I think the city fathers felt that we needed room to grow and that that should all be part of the city. But their argument in the court, their legal argument, was really that when this was Mexican land, there was a land grant calling the city of San Francisco, what became the city, a pueblo. And a pueblo is entitled to a certain amount of land, and if it included the entire outside lands, that was the amount of land that San Francisco would be. So their argument was really, we are a pueblo. And the federal government argued it's not a pueblo. And when it was finally decided that it was, then all that land became part of the city.
And therefore, they could get city services as well, and the city could actually build and expand the city.
Right.
How did it get the name Sunset?
Well, there are books, including possibly my first one, that have it wrong, that say that there was a developer, Aurelius Buckingham, who called his development the Sunset. But a local historian, Angus McFarlane, who's a friend of mine, did a lot of research, and he found that there was a group that was forming of residents within the inner Sunset. In the 1880s or 1890s, and they decided at the end of a meeting that they needed to decide on a name for themselves. And one person, Gus Fox, said, well, why don't we call ourselves the Sunset Improvement Club after that beautiful sunset we just saw? Now, people laugh, and you're smiling, because the sunset's famous for not having sun.
So much right. Appearances. And...
But this was their meeting was at 9th and Lincoln.
And
on a good day. And the cover of my book, Stories in the Sand, has the most incredible sunset taken on Judah Street. And they probably had a really good sunset. And at 9th and Lincoln, without the buildings and the trees, they probably could see that sunset.
I thought it was maybe a realtor that decided to call it the sunset to attract people to buy some.
That's where I think the Aurelius Buckingham story came from.
So how did it transform from basically beach and sand into a thriving neighborhood?
Well, that's what I consider the most remarkable thing about the sunset, and that's that in a relatively short period of time, builders went out there and began covering acres and acres of sand dunes with houses. And we're talking, I interviewed people who lived in a house in the 40s and their street ended at the corner. There was nothing cut through because there were no more houses to be built yet. And nowadays, it's all cut through. Everyone's pretty familiar with the grid out in the sunset. But it happened really quickly. Most of the building was done in the 30s and the 40s by a lot of different builders. But the biggest one was Henry Dolger, who built thousands of houses. And this gave people an opportunity to live not just in downtown or in areas that were really densely populated in the city, but to actually own a home and raise their family in a home. And that really wasn't accessible for people for many, many years. And so it was very popular, and these houses sold like crazy. And so there are pictures taken around 1900 where it's primarily sand dunes, and there are pictures taken around 1940, and it's all built.
What's striking when one sees some aerial shots of San Francisco, you can really see that area was sand dunes. I know there's been a tremendous tree planting effort by folks like the Friends of the Urban Forest. But talk to me about the early people that planted what is a significant amount of greenery that's there.
It is true that Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park, was asked to do Golden Gate Park, and he didn't think it could be done, and he declined. And one of his comments was that there aren't any beautiful trees in San Francisco, and that was true. There were no tall trees.
Wow.
It was all a lot of sand dunes all over the city and scrub brush and maybe live oaks, but not really the tall trees that we see when we walk around Golden Gate Park or up at Sutro Mount Sutro. They were all planted, and one of the people who did do a lot of the planting was Adolph Sutro, who's known for Sutro Baths and owning the Cliff House at one point and Sutro Heights Park. But Mount Sutro, which is behind UCSF, and that land was given by Sutro to the state. But that mountain is covered with mostly eucalyptus and some other trees, and they were all planted.
It's fascinating now that there's controversy about removing those trees that it was originally a sand dune for all intents and purposes. Sand dunes with a mountain.
Yeah, right. There was a mountain with its own ecosystem and its own type of plants that were native to that hill, to that mountain. Same with Mount Davidson, the one with the cross. That had no trees on it in 1880.
Speaking of native species, we lost a butterfly as a result, or almost made a butterfly extinct by developing the Sunset District, I understand.
I'm impressed that you know that. The Xerxes blue butterfly used to fly all over the Sunset and in the Presidio. And the last one seen was in 1941 in the Presidio. And it is believed that it is one of the first butterflies, at least, if not insects, to go extinct because of human development.
You mentioned early on that the Sunset is a grid for the most part and incorporates many neighborhoods, not just this. We call the region the Sunset, but there are many neighborhoods involved. Let's talk about the street names. I understand they originally were just letters of the alphabet. How did they get some of the distinctive names?
Well, that began to happen in 1908 is when they were really talking about it, because the post office was complaining about how hundreds of mail was being misdelivered every day. We didn't have zones or zip codes or anything. And there was 26th Avenue out in the Sunset, and there was 26th Avenue South in the Bayview. And so it started because the post office was complaining. But then
We complain about the post office.
Yeah, now we complain. Yeah, right. And they're disappearing, too, just like the butterfly. The streets were letters of the alphabet, and in 1909, when they changed the letters, I personally, having grown up in the Parkside, was really happy that they kept the alphabetical nature of them. But I didn't know that they were originally letters starting in the Richmond with A, which became Anza, and going through X in the Sunset. And they picked a lot of different names that the Board of Supervisors felt had contributed to the history of the state and of the region. And they went A through W. And then when they got to X, they couldn't think of something people could pronounce. So they changed it to Y and called it Yorba. And so that's kind of the street name. But some of them were the Parkside Realty Company, which had begun building in the early 1900s. They named streets like Terravel and Uloa, and the Board of Supervisors said, we'll keep the streets that they named.
So that's a relatively new neighborhood as far as San Francisco goes. Are there any historical buildings that are a part of what we call the Sunset District?
Well, these days, the landmarking people think if a building is more than 50 years old and people want to alter it, they have to get a permit to do that, and it has to be analyzed in some way. And most of the building was now done over 50 years ago. I'm not sure that a lot of these cookie-cutter, stuck-together houses that all look the same will get some kind of special status. But there are a lot of buildings out there that are much more interesting. And one of them is the Trocadero in Stern Grove. It is a Victorian house that was put in that area when people lived there, and it is still there and available for parties and weddings and special occasions.
When did Sigmund Stern come into the Sunset?
Oh, he didn't.
Oh, he didn't. Okay.
The Sterns, Sigmund and Rosalie Stern, were very well known in the early days of the city. They helped found the San Francisco Opera. And like all the wealthy benefactors of the city, they didn't live in the Sunset. But they contributed to it in the sense that it was actually Sigmund Stern died, and his wife Rosalie wanted to find a park that could be given to the city in his name. And that is how Sigmund Stern Grove came to be. And in fact, it's a deep gully, and it would all have been filled in and developed like all the rest of the Sunset if she hadn't done that.
Wow.
So she's a real heroine to me.
Fantastic. Now, I was intrigued by reading about the early days of the Sunset. Maybe you can tell me, give me a better time frame. We know historically that there was an area called Carville down there. So tell me why this area of the Sunset was called Carville.
In the late 1800s, the city started electrifying streetcars and cable cars that had been horse-drawn. And the cars that were obsolete were being kind of dumped out where there was land, and there was lots of land out by the beach. And a lot of that land was also owned by Sutro. But what happened originally was that there were different clubhouses that met out there, way out in the outside lands near the beach, a bicycle riding club, a card playing club. And they started using these cars as clubhouses. And then people started moving into them because there were so many of them. You could rent the land, but buy a car without seats for $15 and with seats for $20.
Oh, those were the days.
Yeah, those were the days. Actually, and there are some pictures of people who wanted, obviously, a multi-story home, so there are three cars on top of each other. It was really kind of a fascinating bohemian community that developed by the 1900s. There were about 100 families that lived out there. There's actually someone, Woody LaBounty, has written the best book that anyone could write about Carville, and I recommend that highly. It's a lot of fun, too. But what happened after the 1906 earthquake really is that the Carville houses and the area had become Carville by the Sea is what it was called. They were deteriorating, and people really wanted to move out there and have real houses, larger, firmer, you know, more connected to the ground houses. And so they became a neighborhood that they called themselves Oceanside. And there was a school, and that became very developed, and Carville kind of faded away by the 1920s. And then later Oceanside faded away when the people, probably we think, because the people wanted to be part of the Sunset.
Fascinating. Lori, it's obvious you have a passion for this neighborhood, and you'll be leading this tour, Inner Sunset, Birth of a Neighborhood, on September 11th from 3 to 5.
Right. And we will see some very interesting buildings.
Lori Ungaretti, local historian and author of Stories in the Sand, San Francisco's Sunset District, 1847 to 1964, and then and now, San Francisco's Sunset District, as well as San Francisco's Sunset District, another book also by Arcadia Publishing. You can find out more about this special tour on September 11th at archandcity.org. Lori, thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thank you.
First Thursday of the month is when I like to invite Joshua Cosman on to talk about the month ahead in classical music. Not live this week, but through the magic of radio, recorded earlier this week, as they say, for broadcast at this time. Joshua, welcome back.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
High holy season for the performing arts has begun here in the Bay Area in the fall, and more opera on your plate, I understand.
That's very true, and the San Francisco Symphony season has already begun, displaced a day because of the high holidays, but as we look ahead to the opera season, there's a number of really delectable operatic offerings coming our way this month, and then, of course, in the rest of the fall. The big ticket item this month will be the world premiere of Dolores Claiborne at the San Francisco Opera. That opens on September 18th. This is a commissioned premiere from composer Tobias Picker with a libretto by J.D. McClatchy, and it's based on the Stephen King novel, which is a wonderful piece of writing. If nothing else, I'm grateful for the arrival of this opera because it got me to read my first Stephen King novel, which I had never done, and I'd always heard that he was a terrific writer, and it turns out to be true. Dolores Claiborne is a terrific novel, and the Taylor Hackford movie that got made based on it with Kathy Bates and Jennifer Jason Leigh also turns out to be a wonderful piece of work, very different in its way. The composer and the librettist have emphasized that this is a piece based more directly on the novel than on the film. So if you're going to it with the movie in mind, put that aside. The focus is very different in the book.
There was J.D. McClatchy adapting the Stephen King.
Exactly. There was a little bit of backstage drama about it just a few weeks ago when the title role was written for the great mezzo-soprano Dolores Zajac, a local favorite and a graduate of the Marilla program and the Adler Fellowship here, and always a great favorite on San Francisco stages. But she had been struggling with it, I guess, with some of the physical demands of the role. She's her knees are not what they ought to be. So she stepped out, and Patricia Rissett, who's on hand to sing roles in Mephistopheles, which is the opening night production, she's going to step in. She's got an amazing sort of multi-pronged season with the San Francisco Opera this year. She's going to now be singing in Mephistopheles and Dolores Claiborne in the fall, and then come back in June to sing roles in Showboat and Madama Butterfly.
Wow, she's got a busy year. Earlier this hour, I was talking with Dawn Harms, who plays violin with the opera, and we're talking a little bit about the drama involved with the cast change. It's quite something. So that's going to be conducted by George Manahan also.
Yes.
And directed by James Robinson. You like
exactly.
His work. Please.
No, I was just going to say George Manahan is a longtime advocate of new music and a very good conductor based mostly in New York, but this is going to be his first time conducting here in San Francisco and long overdue in my view.
So it's got incest, it's got spousal abuse, a fun night at the opera for all ahead. Performance schedule through October 4th at sfopera.com. Would be remiss if we didn't mention some news this week about Lofty Mansouri as well. Thank you for that.
Yeah, Lofty Mansouri, who was the general director of the San Francisco Opera from, excuse me, until 2001, and who died on Friday after a bout with pancreatic cancer. And a great showman, a great gambler, and a wonderful presence in the opera house. Very ebullient and lively person, and always wonderful and fun to talk to. And had an absolutely infectious belief in taking chances and doing things, and trying things out, and seeing what could be done. He commissioned a great number of operas here, including Dead Man Walking and Dangerous Liaisons, Streetcar Named Desire, some others that are escaping me at the moment. But of course, his...
And brought super titles to opera.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, just amazing.
Yeah.
So there's a remembrance of him at sfopera.com. You wrote a wonderful obituary, which you can read at sfgate.com.
Thanks.
And there's another remembrance at SFCV, San Francisco Classical Voice.org. But more opera is on your plate for the month of September. Tell us more.
Opera San Jose will be opening its season this weekend, September 7th, at the California Theater with Verdi's Falstaff. This is one of those interesting bits of scheduling juju that we've got Falstaff in San Jose in September and then at San Francisco Opera in October. So this is your chance to see it in a little more of an intimate venue. As always with Opera San Jose, there are two alternating casts. They have their resident company of singers. And so two bass baritones, Scott Bearden and Stephen Condy, will be trading off the title role.
It's interesting how those works do come in pairs and some community orchestras as well. I remember there was like a Mahler 1 where almost all Bay Area orchestras was doing Mahler 1 at some point in the fall season.
It
or
does
Rachmaninoff 3rd or something.
I'm sure the statisticians can tell us how likely that is or whether one could expect that just by chance. But there does seem to be something in the air. So that'll be opening their season on September 7th. That's operasj.com.
And opera closer to the Bay Area, West Edge Opera.
Yeah, West Edge Opera, which, of course, began its life as Berkeley Opera, will be returning to Berkeley for a semi-staged production of Barber's opera, Vanessa, the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera from the late 50s, based on works of Isaac Dinesen. And they'll be doing two performances at the Berkeley Rep with Marie Plett in the title role and the young up-and-coming mezzo-soprano named Nicola Prince, whom I have not heard, but who of whom they speak highly. She'll be playing the role of Erica, the niece who's trapped in the house there with her maiden aunt.
That's on the 21st and the 22nd, a semi-staged production, but with a full orchestra and chorus.
I believe that's right.
and more information at westedgeopera.org. It is considered one of the great American operas. So why don't we hear a little excerpt from Barber's Vanessa? Tell us this aria.
This is the early aria from Act One. This is sort of the most commonly excerpted show piece. This is the aria, Must the Winter Come So Soon, that Erica sings as she sits and looks out the window of her snowed-in home.
And who are we hearing in this recording?
I'm sorry. This is a recording from 1958 with Rosalind Elias as Erica and Dimitri Mitropoulos conducting.
Music from Barber's Vanessa. From Samuel Barber's Vanessa, Must the Winter Come So Soon? That was Rosalind Elias. You'll hear Nicola Prince sing that lovely aria with West Edge Opera at Berkeley Rep. More information at westedgeopera.org. Those performances on the 21st and the 22nd of this month. Let's move a little away from opera now and see what else is going on in September.
Sure. One of the things that's happening is the New Century Chamber Orchestra with its dynamic music director, Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg, will open their season at the end of September. And, of course, every year since she's been here, she's taken the opportunity to focus a season on a particular composer, to play a lot of that composer's works and get a commissioned premiere out of them. This year, the focus is Michael Dougherty, who's a very prominent composer, a very tall composer out of Michigan, and has had a lot of works done here over the years. A composer who embraces all kinds of pop culture and classical vein and combines them in one. The opening season, there's going to be a world premiere coming in November, from him. But as a prep, they're going to devote their opening season almost exclusively to some of his music for strings. And if I tell you the titles, you'll get the idea of the kind of spirit in which he writes. There's Elvis Everywhere, Viola Zombie, Regrets Only, Strut, and Viva. This is not a guy who's genteel in any way in his musical aesthetic, which is one of the things I like about him. So that will be performed at various locations around the Bay from September 26th through 29th in Mountain View, Berkeley, San Francisco, and San Rafael.
Once again, ncco.org for that website for information for the New Century Chamber Orchestra. Dawn also mentioned that she is co-concertmaster, but she's actually sitting out that set.
So she is? Oh, that's too bad. Yeah. Well, she's got a lot on her plate now with her new orchestra
and whatnot.
And the other thing that's of interest coming this month is the San Francisco Symphony, which a year or so ago announced a new commissioning program called New Voices, where they seek out young up-and-coming composers and get a new piece out of them. And the very first fruits of that program are going to be heard this month at San Francisco Symphony. A young Canadian composer named Zosia De Castri, about whom I know nothing except her name, but evidently she has impressed the powers that be at the symphony, including music director Michael Tilson Thomas. And so she has written a new piece for the orchestra called Lineage, and we're going to look forward to seeing what she's got. Also on that program, Yefim Bronfman is going to play the Tchaikovsky First Piano Concerto, and MTT will conduct the Prokofiev Third Symphony. That's September 11th through 14th at Davies Symphony Hall, with information, as always, at sfsymphony.org.
A busy month ahead.
Yes.
Diving both ears into the fall performing arts season.
Exactly. I always look forward to it after the doldrums of August. You know, get back into the swing of things is always exciting.
Well, we'll check in again in a month.
Great. Thanks for having me, David.
Thank you, Josh. Josh mentioned composer Zosia DeCastri. Well, we will learn more about her music next week on Open Air. Be sure to tune in. My next guest comes from a very artistic family. His mother was an artist and his father a director. And like his brother Oscar, he is a professional operatic bass. He is Grammy Award-winning bass baritone Ildar Azdrazakov, who returns to San Francisco Opera to sing the title role in their current production of Arrigo Boito's Mephistopheles. Welcome to KLW, Oscar.
Hello. Thank you.
Ildar.
Thank you.
This does mark a return to you for you to San Francisco Opera. What was your previous role here?
The first time when I was here, it was, I think, 2005. Mm-hmm. I'm doing Italiano in Algeria with the great conductor Ranicles and with the great opera singer from Russia, is Olga Borodina.
Very nice.
Yeah. And now?
You're back.
Fortunately, I'm back and I'm here to singing my favorite role.
Is it your favorite?
Yeah, for today is my favorite role. It's Mephistopheles, of course.
Right. Did you know that Boito is also the son of an artist?
Boito?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The composer.
Yeah.
This is such an iconic role for singers like Sam Raimi, making it their signature role. Do you maybe worry about comparisons, or are you looking forward to owning it as your own and perhaps being known as the next
of course,
iconic Mephistopheles?
Of course, Sam Raimi is the great bass today, the great in the world, and we know, of course, he's Mephistopheles from the video, from audio, and from the who saw his performance on stage. But unfortunately, I saw only video, and when I was young, when I was 18 years old, my brother showed me Mephistopheles of Boito, the same production with Sam. It was amazing. It was amazing. And I didn't thinking about in the future to sing this role. So now I'm here in the same opera house.
All right. That's correct, yeah.
After 24 years.
Uh-huh.
For Mephistopheles.
Have you sung other productions of Mephistopheles?
No, never. Never. This is my first time.
But you've sung the role of Mephistopheles before.
I sang like just concert form.
Okay.
I sang with Nicola Luisotti and with Ramon Vargas, too. Uh-huh. And now we are here and doing the same.
I understand you did Gounod's Mephistopheles.
I did Gounod Mephistopheles, and I did Damnation of Faust, which is also Mephistopheles.
Okay.
Role.
So yeah. It's a role that
but
you're...
The amazing thing is all these operas, my debut, like Mephistopheles, was... with Ramon Vargas, like Faust. So, Damnation of Faust was Ramon Vargas. Gounod Faust is Ramon Vargas. Now, also Ramon, like Faust. It's amazing.
Well, that's terrific. Now, how do the parts compare, Mephistopheles, that you've sung? Is this the best devil you could sing compared to the devil in Faust?
For today, is the best devil, of course. And... the Mephistopheles is a role of it's a beautiful role. You can it's a very powerful, very beautiful arias, and the musically is I think the Boito wrote this opera. It's such a great music. Of course, the first time when he wrote the Mephistopheles, it was big scandal. It was unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. Part of Faust, he wrote for baritone. And after a few years, he wrote now what we can see, can hear now. So this music for and the part of Faust, the tenor singing.
Tell me a little bit about this production at San Francisco Opera. I understand that it might be a little racy. There's a little warning about some of the...
It's still one of the best productions in the world. It's also, it's not new. It's 24 years old. But it's so beautiful. And I just want to say to Robert Carson to do many, many of the beautiful productions, more and more. Because I did his production at La Scala. It was Tales of Hoffman. It also was such a beautiful production. And that production also, fantastic.
Yeah. Is this a contemporary setting of the opera? Modern, or is it period? What are the costumes like?
The costume is, no, it's not modern. But the it's a beautiful. It's everything there, and I think is when you come and see, you understand exactly from which temporary, you say which temporary is coming.
Sure, contemporary setting.
Contemporary.
There you go. Now, what are the difficulties of this particular part? You mentioned how beautiful the music is and how the arias are so captivating. Is it more difficult on the acting front or on the musical production front for you?
With this production, it's difficult to because you need to acting. You need to acting. I need to jumping to the table and then to, how you say, fischiare. Whistle.
Whistle, right?
Yeah.
The famous whistling aria, which we'll hear shortly.
My whistling is not so well, and someone will whistle for me.
Okay.
And I have three arias in this opera, and all three arias is a beautiful. It's a prologue. It's fantastic. And Notte di Sabba. Mm-hmm. It's one of the beautiful pieces, and when I'm not only singing, and the end of Notte di Sabba, I will conducting.
Nice.
That's amazing. That's beautiful. I enjoy it.
Do you aspire to do some conducting as well, Don?
Yeah.
What other roles are you looking for? It seems like the evil roles seem much more fun for bass baritones.
You know, the tenors is the romantics and the lovers. Baritone is more heroical and basses, evils or kings. It's the opera life.
What's coming up next for you after Mefistofele?
After Mefistofele, I'm going to Chicago, singing Requiem di Verdi with Maestro Muti. And then he invited me to the Rome Opera Theater to do Ernani. It also it will be first time for me. And after Ernani, I come back to America. In New York, I will do Prince Igor. It's also first time for me.
Where will that be done? What opera house in New York?
In Metropolitan Opera.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I believe you were there in 2004. Very nice. There are several opera houses in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'd like to ask you what roles you're looking forward to learning.
The next is Ernani.
One at a time.
The Silva. Yeah, I sang many times aria from this opera. Many times. And I won the competition in Italy with this aria. And now, finally, I go to sing the whole opera with Riccardo Muti conducting.
That should be very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, all the performance information of Mefistofele is at sfopera.com. Performances are Wednesday, September 11th. Actually, opens this Friday, tomorrow, and runs through October 2nd. Information at sfopera.com. Let's go out with an excerpt from the famous whistling aria from Boito's Mefistofele. Tell us what the devil you're up to here in this whistling aria.
Oh, he explained it to Mephistopheles, who is... Oh, to Mephistopheles, sorry. To Faust, who is Mephistopheles. So, and you can listen.
All right.
If you want.
This will be Ildar Abdrazakov singing from Boito's Mephistopheles. Bass baritone Ildar Abdrazakov performing Mephistopheles as part of the San Francisco Opening Gala tomorrow evening with runs through October 2nd. Information at sfopera.com. Opera figures a little bit into my next guest, Diane Keough, who's here to tell us and share a few things about some cultural offerings. Diane, welcome back to KLW. Hold on. Once again, I'm sorry we missed you there. I had the other mic on. Hello.
I think it's nice. It's interesting that we were listening to that because I want to talk about Quartet.
It's a movie that came along and went away so quickly that I didn't get a chance to see it in the movie theater, and it was gone for a long time. Couldn't find it anywhere. Finally, I knew that a Blu-ray version had come out, so I started looking on Comcast to see if they had it, and I rented it. And I was really glad that I did. And that kind of music that we were just listening to was part of the music that was played underneath as the show went along. There was a lively mix of background music. The things from the Mikado, Puccini, Verdi, Tosca, the drinking song was even there. And it was an appropriate movie for and with the music underneath about retired opera singers, actors, and musicians. And the music on the soundtrack, by the way, is performed by everyone that you see doing it, except for the very last scene.
Right.
And when you go to see it, you'll understand why. All of these wonderful people were living in a beautiful retirement home in the English countryside named Beecham House, which, by the way, most of the time is used for weddings and special events, but they took it over for the film, which was directed lovingly and beautifully by Dustin Hoffman, which to me was a big surprise. I didn't expect Dustin Hoffman to be able to produce something as beautiful as this. You saw it, right?
I did. In fact, I got the DVD, probably the same one that you had. It had some wonderful extra features, having the actors talk about Dustin Hoffman and him talking about him directing it his first time at the age of 75. So it's really fascinating.
Well, I thought it was good. Here, he was older, they were older, so he had a feeling that was really good about them. It kind of reminded me a little bit of the Marigold Hotel. Same idea, older people retiring, all that sort of thing. But this one was done so much better. The scenery was so gorgeous. I think any place that you looked out when they were out walking around, which they did a good deal of, you could take a picture of and it would be beautiful hanging on your wall. The difference between this and Marigold Hotel is the scenery is beautiful, relaxing, and the pace that they did was quite leisurely, not rushed. Nothing was hurried about it. There wasn't any scrambling. It was all done very softly and quietly. Four people in it that were the main quartet, as it were Tom Courtney, who played Reggie, and he's seen giving a class to a group of younger people in England, a class that explains how opera and rap coexist, they both tell stories in their own way, which I hadn't even thought about it that way.
Mm-hmm. Tom Courtenay, wonderful actor. I just realized that last week when I was subbing for Sarah for Revolutions Per Minute, I featured a recording of Stravinsky's L'Histoire du Soldat that Tom Courtenay was the voice of the soldier back in a recording from the 70s.
It was a great cast. I mean, there were four people that were very exciting. Tom Courtenay, and then there was happy and forgetful and sometimes confused Sissy, played by Pauline Collins. Billy Connolly, who is the equally happy and sometimes conniving, fun lech, and Maggie Smith, who played Jean.
She was great, yeah.
Which she, of course, she looked a lot younger than she does on Downton Abbey. She looks more like herself. But she played it equally as well as she does everything else that she gets involved with. And she had been a member of the original quartet and then left to go off on her own and proceed to be a star by herself. And, of course, now her voice is failing, so she had to retire. She decided to pick Beecham, not knowing that the rest of them were there. So it was a huge surprise when she got there. But it was an even bigger surprise to Reggie because they had been married and she had dissolved that union as well. So it was a little chill in the air for a while when this was going on.
Well, let's move from the area of DVD rentals to live theater, because we're a little bit pressed for time. What's happening down in Foster City?
Well, in Foster City, there's a show going on called Spamalot.
Heard of that.
Isn't that amazing? Well, it really is amazing because Foster City has the Hilbarn Theater, which has been around for 73 years. They opened their 73rd year with Spamalot. And being an absolute nut about Monty Python and all things Python, I went to see it thinking, well, it's good, but it won't be as good as it was at the Golden Gate. It was every bit as good as it was at the Golden Gate. And John O'Hurley was no better than Rush Bohard as King Arthur. It was a great show. The evening was wonderful. They have a 40-foot stage. Most theaters have a 60-foot stage. And so I didn't see how they were going to get this thing put together, but they did. And if you have any kind of information about Spamalot or about Monty Python, you'll understand part of this when they look for a shrubbery, which is very important in Spamalot. Very important.
It's a marvelous parody of the whole movie, and it's well worth the time.
And out came a topiary, which was wonderful. And then, of course, there was the Lady of the Lake that helped him find the Holy Grail, and the Lady of the Lake had the Laker girls. And the costumes were just absolutely terrific. The music was great. Everybody came out of there smiling and happy, which is what we need quite a bit of these days. Just a little note about Hilbarn Theater. It had five homes before it ended up where it is now. And their home, the land was given to them by a member of the Foster family that settled Foster City, which is quite interesting. They wanted to have their own theater there, and they gave it. And today, the daughter, Lee Foster, is the executive director, so it's being kept in the family. But it is run so well. The actors are so good. And just one small quick note, the Black Knight was played by the police chief of Foster City, which I thought was hysterical in itself.
The show is Monty Python's Spamalot at Foster City at the Hilbarn Theater. Information at Hilbarn Theater, that's theaterre.org. Diane, thanks so much for
sharing that. It's
there
until the 22nd.
Until the 22nd. Catch it now. And appropriate as we go into the news, always look on the bright side of life.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Diane. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for his producing assistance with Open Air. I'm David LaTulipe. Our shows are archived at klw.org. Send us a comments there as well. Bamelott at the Hill Barn Theater in Foster City through the 22nd of this month. Information at hillbarntheater.org.